is receiving from Russia in exchange for its troop deployment as he condemned the North's test of an intercontinental ballistic missile Thursday, long enough to reach mainland U.S., a reported first. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Escuchan in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, November 1st, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Palestine to discuss the long history of Latin American solidarity with the Palestinian people from the beginning of the Nakba to recent actions by grassroots organizations and everything in between. And so with us on the show today is Georgi Garza. He's a translator, popular educator, and postdoctoral researcher at Binghamton University in New York. He is also a member of the Faculty for Justice in Palestine. His most recent article in NACLA is entitled Weaving Solidarities Across Abya Yala and Palestine. In Latin America, Palestine not only represents the struggle of a people refusing to submit to subjugation and dispossession, but also evokes the spirit of perseverance, resistance, and the desire to live a dignified life. And he joins us on the show today. Welcome back to the show, Georgi Garza.
Hi, Oscar. It's a pleasure to be here with you today and talking about Latin America and Palestine.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, you also have an article that came out back in August with regards to what we'll be discussing today entitled Weaving Solidarities Across Abya Yala and Palestine. And so this came out in NACLA. And speaking of NACLA, they are going to produce a web series followed by a winter 2024 issue of the NACLA report, delving deeper into the topic of Latin American solidarity with Palestinian self-determination and how it manifests itself in various parts of Latin America. I want to know if you could give us more details about this and if you could tell us more about sort of the thought process in exploring this fascinating dynamic, this fascinating connection between Palestine and Latin America.
Well, thank you, Oscar, for having me here today. And it'd be an honor and a pleasure to talk a little bit about Latin America, or Abiyala, as it's known among grassroots movements throughout and across the continent today. So yeah, to break it down a little bit, NACLA, for those that are unfamiliar, stands for the North American Congress on Latin America. It's been reporting on the politics, the social economic realities, imperialism, empire, resistance, history, grassroots movements, social movements since 1967. They have a really fascinating, strong web presence, NACLA.org. They can check out a lot of different material from all over the Americas, the so-called Americas. So this piece, this series that I was invited to take part as an editor, is kicked off earlier this year. Well, actually, the sort of genesis for it goes back a little bit further. It comes out of an encuentro, a virtual encuentro, a few of us scholars and activists had in response to what is now, you know, we're having this conversation the week of October 7th, which started last year in 2023. In late October, a small contingent of Latin American scholars and activists were deeply impacted by what was going on in Gaza. Given our historical connections, a lot of this coming out of some campuses across North America, including Canada, wanted to respond to this in different ways. And something that came out of that encuentro was holding a virtual forum to go over the deep history of solidarity among peoples, among states in Latin America with the Palestinian people. We held a open virtual forum in the middle of November during Thanksgiving, and this was attended by over 300 people from around the globe. We had participants from India, as far as, you know, in relation to the United States, across Latin America, across the Middle East. We're just fascinated by this because, if you recall, in October, the first countries to break diplomatic ties with Israel were Latin American countries. Colombia, Bolivia. Bolivia had only reinstated diplomatic ties after the 2019 coup. Once again, severed ties. That was followed by Venezuela. And so the Latin American countries were quick to break diplomatic ties with Israel, even before countries in the Middle East. And that wasn't incidental. That has a long historical precedent and is rooted in, as I mentioned, deep histories of solidarity. And so we had this forum, a very lively conversation that lasted about 2 hours. We talked about the, you know, state-level solidarity, indigenous solidarities. And so from that, we picked some ideas to NACLA, and they invited us to develop different projects. One of them is this web series, which my article, Weaving Solidarities Across Abiyala and Palestine, introduces. This web series is a place where past, present, and future pieces on Latin America and Palestine will live. So NACLA has been hosting and publishing articles on Palestine through the lens of Latin American solidarity for years now. So it was only fitting that we finally make a home for this material. And as you mentioned, NACLA produces quarterly issues throughout the year. The next one, due to be released in early winter, in early December of this year, 2024, is going to be dedicated to Latin America and Palestine, and will have full-length articles that are going to more deep political analysis than the web series, which are more sort of timely. And you can check out now in the Abiyala Palestine series.
This large turnout for this virtual encuentro, as you described it, was so vast that I think it sort of reflected in NACLA's coverage in the past 12 months with regards to various articles as it pertains to Latin American solidarity with Palestine. And it's not a uniform thing either. There have been articles in NACLA that stretches from Puerto Rico to Chile to Colombia to Mexico and all sorts of other places in between. And the conversation and the analysis that's been put forth is always different, always nuanced, but always informative. And so this is why I'm so excited to talk to you about this and hopefully see this series come out. You know, I just can't wait. It really has me fascinated as a geography nerd. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you have an article yourself that came out in August entitled Weaving Solidarities Across Abya Yala and Palestine. And so this brings up two questions, although you sort of answered it already. For those who may not know, what is Abya Yala, the meaning of it, the etymology of it? And secondly, according to your article, can you tell us how the Palestine question goes as far back as the 1920s, which included the formation of the League Against Imperialism? Because it's important to note that this solidarity that we're discussing today isn't exclusive to recent events in the last 12 months. This goes as far back, as I said, almost a century ago.
Totally. Thank you for that, Oscar. Two really important questions. Yes. So to your first question, Abya Yala is a term that it comes from the Kuna people from modern day Panama. And it's an indigenous community who use that term to describe, which loosely translates to a land of maturity or land of abundance. They also use it to identify our contemporary world, what in other places could be described as Pachamama or our present world. And this term, Abya Yala, became popularized when an Aymara intellectual activist visited the community in the 1980s during different encuentros from convergences that brought indigenous communities together. And through the sharing of knowledge and conocimientos, was given the sort of approval to take this term and popularize it and utilize it as a sort of critical, and you mentioned yourself as a geography nerd, and this sort of critical geography or otherwise geography that goes beyond the sort of colonial imagination of borders, right? And so a lot of movements have taken this term borrowed from the Kuna people since the 1980s to talk about and represent a different sort of reality, a reality that is not only against colonization, but imagines another world, right? If we borrow that sort of terminology for the Zapatistas of imagining a world of many worlds, this notion of an alternative world, a more just world, a world of plentiful life is something that is shared among a lot of indigenous communities. And so Abya Yala has come to be used over the last few years, a decade or two, as a sort of galvanizing, unifying geography that connects different conocimientos, different geographies, different indigenous communities to imagine a better world. And so many, many groups have used Abya Yala instead of Latin America. And my use of it in this article is to do that, to evoke, to animate these radical traditions of solidarity, resistance, but also creating other worlds. And so it's been popularized by a lot of indigenous movements over the last generation or two. And then to your second question, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, contrary to like the popular kind of mainstream or narrative, this is nothing, solidarity with Palestine is nothing new. And so, and I know we're going to get into this in a moment, but it's multi-layered and at different scales, right? If we think about even state level support, this didn't start, you know, last year on October 7th. In the 1980s, or even the Nakba, but there is a recognition of anti-colonial struggle and solidarity with Palestine and all oppressed peoples early on in the 20th century when the League Against Imperialism was formed in 1927. We have these different convergences in Brussels, in London, then the Bundan Conference later in the 50s, the Bandung Conference later in the 50s. This all stems from the Third World Movement, the Non-Aligned Movement, which traces its roots to this anti-imperialist movement that is also connected to the Second and Third International of the Communist International. That was a broad movement of bringing together working class peoples across different nations. So the Palestinian question emerges around that time as, you know, the fall of the Ottoman Empire, you know, broke up the region, and the European imperial powers went in there to carve it up, right, with the Sykes Picot Agreement and the Balfour Declaration in the early 20th century. A lot of oppressed peoples here in the United States, we have indigenous movements, we have black movements that began to build solidarity with colonized peoples around the world, started seeing their own struggle as colonized subjects within the United States. And so just as these movements were gaining traction, we see the world, the European powers ascend into internal conflict, and then that sort of shifts the sort of narrative, and then we see different kinds of solidarities emerge later in the middle of the 20th century and then in the third quarter of the 20th century.
Another convergence that you actually mentioned in your article is in the 1950s and 60s. And I want to know if you could explain how Cuba played a role, if not a central role, in the development of Palestinian solidarity in Latin America, especially with the equation of Zionism with racism. And I ask this for two reasons. One, I mentioned the 50s and the 60s. This was also a period of a decolonization movement in continental Africa, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific Islands. And I also mention this because if you'll notice, especially in the last 12 months alone, there have been a lot of protests on college campuses with students, as I said before, equating Zionism with racism. So this concept, which people may think is new or recent, again, goes back to something that's been discussed as far back in the 50s and 60s as it pertains to the concept of Zionism and racism, at the very least here in the Western Hemisphere.
Great question. Yes, there's a lot in there. I mean, you know, as with anything else, our language, our perspectives evolve, our, you know, geopolitics evolve and take different meanings across time. And I like how you made that connection with the contemporary discourse around Zionism and racism. We're seeing a lot of campuses actually rewrite their student codes, write in policy to do the inverse and equate anti-Zionism with racism or discrimination, right? And we see the weaponization of that sort of discourse to silence critique. And so going back, you know, to your first question about Cuba, so your listeners probably well aware of this, you know, that Cuba was at the forefront of the global, you know, anti-colonial struggle, anti-imperialist struggle in the 1960s, not only in while it was aligned with the Soviet Union, but also in breaking in a lot of its sort of, you know, political positions from the Soviet Union. As you mentioned, as I bring up in this article, the Soviet Union actually backed the creation of Israel during the partition vote, whereas Cuba was the only country in Latin America to take an active position and rejected the creation of Israel. From the 1960s on, Cuba took this sort of role, this prominent role, given its, you know, independence, its revolution, and its stance against the United States, to host a lot of gatherings, international gatherings of the anti-colonial struggle, and sort of became the host for a lot of these international struggles, bringing together, for example, the tricontinental, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And it was one of the first countries to give diplomatic status to the Palestinian Liberation Organization following the Nakba in the 1960s. It had the Department for the Organization of Solidarity with the People of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And it brought the Palestinian question, or the Palestinian struggle within the broader struggle for independence from colonial powers, and saw the struggle of Palestinian people within the larger global struggle against colonial powers during that time. And so Cuba was instrumental not only in Palestine, but also in Africa for what it did in the Congo and Angola. You know, Cuba, especially under Fidel Castro, really upheld those values of anti-colonial struggle and global solidarity by establishing these networks of support, whether that be medical assistance, military assistance. I mean, it was, you know, many African leaders, when, for example, Castro went to Africa, he was toured, he was paraded as a hero across numerous countries during that time. Nelson Mandela, his first stop after getting released from prison was to go to Cuba and to thank Fidel Castro for what they did in Angola, which allowed the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa to regain its strength. So it wasn't just in Palestine, but Africa and a lot of the, you know, oppressed people around the world. And so it's no surprise to go into the archives and to see Cuba stand alongside the Palestinian people. And into your last point on the UN resolution, yes, this was in 1973. Cuba took the stance of sponsoring the UN resolution 3379, which equated Zionism with racism, which today would seem something, you know, so far-fetched given the sort of reactionary responses that we're seeing on college campuses and in popular discourse. But that wasn't always the case. I mean, the global support for Israel, and we don't have enough time to go over this history, but it took some time. And so as with any sort of colonial project, right, you know, it takes some time to produce a sort of counter narrative to history and justify everything that's going on. And that's really important to kind of pay attention as we read history, as we critically analyze these different moments. But Zionism ultimately is a political project. It's a project of settler colonialism. And so Cuba didn't find any difficulty in equating that with racism because it's predicated on the elimination of a particular people here, the indigenous people of that region, the Palestinians. Something that, as you mentioned, they seem so far away from us at this time, but in the 1970s was something that could actually be presented to the UN.
Yeah, you certainly made the argument in your article that Cuba played a central role in the 50s and 60s with regards to the Palestinian question. But as I said at the beginning of the show, Latin American solidarity with Palestine manifests itself differently from country to country. Cuba itself is not even necessarily central to solidarity itself. It manifests itself so many different ways in so many countries. We've gone this deep into the conversation and haven't even mentioned the Palestinian diaspora in Chile, which is something that I feel like it's a one-hour conversation in and of itself. As a matter of fact, we did a whole show on that several years ago about how that community even predates the Nakba and goes as far back as the late 19th century. Now, as an example of how this manifests itself in several different ways, you also make a comparison. Well, maybe not a comparison is the right word, but you certainly bring up the Zapatistas in Mexico in your article when it comes to Palestinian solidarity. Can you explain to us how this is sort of different from what we just discussed as it pertains to Cuba, but still leads us to the same road of solidarity with the Palestinian people and the Palestinian question itself?
Yeah, thank you for that, Oscar. So you're going to have to bear with me a little bit as we can deepen this sort of response, takes it into a deeper, more kind of theoretical place. And I think it's necessary here to understand the Zapatista intervention. So if we understand, so the sort of dimension or the lens from which solidarity, state-level solidarity, that is governments as they define themselves through their national borders, that sort of discourse of solidarity is organized around anti-colonial, anti-imperialism. However, the Zapatistas, and as a refresher for your listeners who may not be familiar with the Zapatistas, they've been described as a neo-indigenous or movement out of Chiapas, Mexico, that emerged in the 1980s. But, you know, as in their formal organization, make their public declaration in the Lecondón Jungle Declaration in 1994 and seek to develop an autonomous form of governance through different indigenous communities coming together and forming shared governance structure around caracoles and a rotating leadership and other elements of the conocimientos, the knowledges from place-based peoples. They are in Mexico, but not of Mexico, right? Mexico continues, even with a lot of these progressive governments, continues to exploit many of the resources at the expense of indigenous communities. One example is the Tren Maya, for example, that's currently underway in southeastern Mexico. So we have state level, which would be the progressive Mexican government, and then we have internal struggles within it of indigenous peoples on who the states were imposed upon. And so Cuba can build its solidarity as anti-colonial. They don't want, you know, European powers to intervene. But yeah, what happens when your own, you know, your own government is doing that sort of displacing and that exploitation, right? The sort of internal colonization that the Bolivian sociologist Celia Cusicanqui describes. And so solidarity from indigenous communities is organized around that sort of struggle, a sort of historical struggle that predates states and goes further back than just the 20th century, but goes back 500 years to 1492 and the expansion of Europe beyond its continent and the colonization and dispossession of peoples in other territories. And so I included the Zapatistas here because they do a great job in articulating and contextualizing what's happening to Palestine, not only within the Nakba, beyond just the Nakba and beyond even the 100-year history of imperialism, but going back to what enabled and what justifies this sort of dispossession is this colonial logic that emerges 500 years ago. So they make the connection between indigenous struggles in the Americas and Palestinians, right? Palestinians are allowed, within the colonial imaginary, the colonial logic, you cannot exist. The existence of Palestinians at the same time that Israelis exist is a sort of distortion. And so that needs to be corrected according to the colonial mind. And the people that were there previously are made invisible either through real or imagined or indirect violence, right? I mean, this is the whole, you know, we can get into the whole historical imaginary for the United States, for example, and how it compares to Israel, the same way there's been numerous, you know, comparative studies between indigenous peoples. Stephen Salatiel, I'm sure if you're familiar with, is a writer of Palestinian Salvadorian descent who makes a lot of comparison between indigeneity and the discourse around the sort of savage terrorists and, you know, barbarians, in the same discourse that was used 500 years ago to justify the terror that's imposed upon the people that are already there. The prevailing, right, narrative around Zionism and the founding of Zionism and Israeli state is that it was a land without a people for a people without a land, right? The sort of imagining this vacant land, the same way that the, you know, United States Turtle Island was imagined. They needed to be conquered, and it needed to be taken over and developed because the indigenous people there didn't do anything to it, right? And so the Zapatistas do a great job in doing this sort of comparative historical analysis of placing what's happening to Palestinians and the sort of indifference within the global stage within the context of colonialism and connecting the violence that they're experiencing there to the violence that we're experiencing in other parts of the world, right? Palestinians are allowed to suffer well within the grand, you know, powers that be because of what's going on in other places, right? So while violence touches down, colonialism and global structures of power are universal and operate across the globe, they touch down in very unique ways, right? In different places, whether that's Palestine, whether that's the urban ghetto, whether that's indigenous communities that are dispossessed for extractivism. But all of this is connected within this sort of colonial, modern logic of dispossession and exploitation, which we live under.
Thank you for that analysis. I've made the argument that what we're seeing in Gaza right now is the Trail of Tears in the modern day, with television, with news, with social media happening in real time. And it's not beyond the realm of possibility. We've gone beyond that at this point, and we could call what we're seeing in Gaza right now in a variety of ways. A massacre, a genocide, call it what you will. It's the killing of the indigenous people in that land, no different to the development of the United States centuries ago. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with George Igarza, who's a translator, popular educator, and a postdoctoral researcher at Binghamton University in New York. He's also a member of the Faculty for Justice in Palestine. His recent article in NACLA is entitled Weaving Solidarities Across Abya Yala and Palestine. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
على ديني على أرض تلاقيني أنا لأهلي أنا فديهم أنا دمي فلسطيني 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 أنا دمي فلسطيني We'll be right back.
That was Mohammed Asaf, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about Latin American solidarity with Palestine with George Igarza, who is a translator, popular educator, and postdoctoral researcher at Binghamton University in New York. He is also a member of the Faculty for Justice in Palestine. So before we continue this conversation, George, I just want to make a note here that we are going to create a link to your NACLA article on our Twitter account so people can learn more about this amazing story and about this upcoming web series as well. I forgot to mention that in your article, there is a graffiti of a pro-Palestine artwork in your article, and it's from Peru, and it's actually written in Quechua. And I bring this up to you because it sort of brings up one of the main points that I made at the very beginning, that this solidarity movement manifests itself in different ways, even amongst the indigenous peoples of Latin America itself. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about this artwork, because again, we're going to create a link on our Twitter account so people can learn more. But it sort of serves as an example of how people can view what's taking place in Palestine through various lenses in various countries, but still come up to the same conclusion of understanding the parallels between these two worlds, Palestine and Latin America.
Yeah, thank you, Oscar. For those of you who have not pulled up the article yet, the graffiti says Causachu Palestina, which is Quechua for long live Palestine. I just came back from a trip to Peru over this summer. I was there in July and August, and I was walking through Cusco, and you know, like other Latin American countries, we cannot homogenize these countries because of, you know, historical colonial episodes have, you know, concentrated certain populations in certain areas. And so, you know, Peru is far from a homogenous country. Cusco is, you know, for your listeners that may know this already, was the imperial capital of the Tahuantinsuyo, which is the Incan Empire. And it has the largest indigenous populations. What's interesting here is that when I went to Lima, the capital, which is much more westernized, I was hard-pressed to find any pro-Palestinian graffiti or artwork, if any. I don't recall actually seeing any. I was only there for a couple of weeks. I spent most of my time in Cusco. But as soon as I landed, I was greeted by pro-Palestinian graffiti and street art graphics throughout the city, including this one that kept reemerging. That was Causachu Palestina, long live Palestine. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, it's not difficult to make those comparisons between dispossession and exploitation and colonial violence in you know, the so-called Americas and Abiyala with what's happening in Palestine. It's sort of like holding up a mirror to, you know, what happened, what transpired here 500 years ago, which is still going on in many ways in different regions. And so it didn't surprise me to see how prominent, you know, pro-Palestinian artwork was in Cusco, especially among, you know, the densely indigenous, highly indigenous community in the southern, in southern Peru. Given its historical significance, you know, Cusco was invaded, was the capital of the Incas, and this is where Tupac Amaru II tried to, you know, reclaim the territory and the city and started the largest insurrection in the Americas, indigenous insurrection in the Americas in 1780. This is the also where Nicanor Bastidas, his partner, and Tupac Amaru, Bartolina Sisa, the southern Andean region is just well known for resistance, indigenous resistance. Most recently, and 2 years ago in Peru, there was a state-led massacre of indigenous people where over 36 or 50 people lost their lives, with complete indifference in the state, right? And so this is still going on in Latin America across different countries. And so there's this concept in Latin America called sentir pensar, this notion of thinking and feeling. And I believe a lot of this was invoked in the construction of a lot of this artwork. As you can see, one of the articles in the NACLA web series, Mayra Millán, who is an indigenous Mapuche leader, had penned a letter late last year in response to what was going on in Gaza and seeing, you know, the dispossession and the violence of her community, the Mapuche community, reflected in the suffering of Palestinians, right? And so it's not, it doesn't take long for communities who have experienced similar violence to find, you know, and build solidarity with Palestinians, because again, even more so than academics are quick to make these connections between these sort of global assemblages of power and the way that they've personally been affected and how they're seeing it to transpire live today. And yeah, and so this, and what I also, just to share with your audience members too, if they've ever been to Cusco, they plan to go to Cusco in the near future, there's this big Cristo Blanco, like a white Christ statue overlooking the city that looks down on the plaza from the surrounding Apus, one of the surrounding mountains. And that Cristo Blanco was actually donated by Palestinians in the early 1940s.
Really?
Yeah. And it's got the plaque that's commemorates that. And they were merchants who arrived there in the first quarter of the 20th century and dedicated the Cristo Blanco to the hospitality of Cusqueños, of the indigenous community. And I just found that really powerful, you know, given the time, not only for the fact that they had, you know, appreciated the Cusqueño hospitality that is still very much present there, having experienced it myself in August and July. What was really fascinating was that they identified as Palestinians even before 1948, right? And so this sort of shatters this sort of myth that Palestinians do not exist, that Israelis like to perpetuate, but nevertheless identify themselves as Palestinos and had this, yeah, beautiful, left behind this beautiful legacy there in Cusco. So I think that's a really nice story.
I can't speak for the whole audience, but I can tell you right now that Peru is certainly on my bucket list of one of those places I wish I could visit for the music, the food, the culture, all of it. I love Peru. I wish I could go one of these days. But you may have sort of answered my next question already, but I have to say that you've done a very good job in this article in crystallizing the connection between Latin America and Palestine, particularly the Palestinian question, because there's a point in your article where you turn the Palestinian question into an internal question and almost into sort of an internal awakening. So I'll give you an example. So when it comes to grassroots solidarity for Palestine, one of your arguments in your NACLA article is the following. Quote, "This grassroots solidarity is fueled by a deep connection to shared histories of violence as well as an understanding of how centralized power and colonial violence extend globally across imagined borders." I want to know if you could elaborate on how Palestine sort of serves to awaken the body politic in Latin America, in various countries, to their own colonial history. Again, I feel like you sort of answered this already, but this is a point in your article that I think deserves a greater spotlight.
Yeah. Thank you. A lot has been said about the way in which we've come to be inspired by the resistance, the refusal of Palestinians to accept their conditions and their realities. A lot of us are inspired by the way they continue to forge community, make life where life is denied for them. And this very much, I think, touches a lot of, especially indigenous Afro-descendant communities, those that have for 500 years been pushing back and creating life against the harsh, violent, anti-Black, anti-Indigenous conditions that have been set upon us by nation states, by colonialism, by dispossession. So it's, you know, to see this in that region, and this is what brought out a lot, I think, of the solidarity that we've seen, you know, even the very kind of communist-focused ones, oriented ones in the 1960s and 70s. But the most, and I argue in this article, right, the longest-lasting and the most persistent form of solidarity that has transcended regimes and political ideologies has been that sort of simple fact of wanting to create a life, you know, outside, predicated on dignity, our respect, and commonality, as opposed to one predicated even on ideology, you know, whether that be a sort of communist or anti-colonial ideology. But the form of solidarity that has lasted the longest and has been so consistent has been this shared sort of worldview among indigenous communities, among Afro-descendant communities, among indigenous Palestinian communities, to create another world beyond this sort of violence and conflict. And I think, at the risk of sounding, you know, kind of too romantic, I think this is what the oppressors always, the oppressors in some way kind of recognize this. And this is why they must resort to violence, right? To eliminate us, because there is no alternative. They can't win us over through popular discourse or even, you know, by any facts, because they don't have any, right? They have to rely on violence to subdue and coerce, and they have to rely on power, coercive power, to control and get their agenda across, right? And then have the audacity to label those that resist that the terrorists, right? But what is the most sort of basic definition of the terrorist but someone utilizing or wielding power to advance a political goal, right? So that's what's so threatening. And I think that's what's been so powerful and something that's shared across these different communities that are, you know, thousands of miles apart and yet find such deep affinity and solidarity, not only in the way that they resist, but in the way that they create another world, right, in their daily struggles.
Thank you for that answer. And I just want to say something very clear to the audience that doesn't get mentioned very often, that even if the massacre taking place in Gaza were the issue of self-determination of the Palestinian people would continue so long as this occupation, this form of modern-day colonialism continues. And it's a colonialism that a lot of people in Latin America, in various corners of Latin America, are all too familiar with. So long as this form of modern-day colonialism continues, this question will still arise and the struggle will still continue. So I'm sounding a little bit romantic myself, but it's something that's worth bearing in mind, that if this massacre were to end tomorrow, the issue, the great Palestine question, will continue so long as the colonialism that has created this set of events in place continues as well. Now, we have about 5 minutes left. And like I said before, we're going to create a Twitter link to your article, and we're certainly going to highlight several of the upcoming articles that will come out from the next NACLA report, which will be exclusively on Latin American solidarity with Palestine. I want to know if you give us some more information before we let you go, some other articles that are worth highlighting. I could say right now that earlier this year, I had the pleasure of speaking with both Nikki Duda, who did the comparison between the Mapuches and the Chileans of Palestinian descent. I've also had the pleasure of speaking with Mark Lewis Taylor, who pointed out Israel's role in the genocide that took place in Guatemala back in the early 80s. And so I feel like every article that's coming out from NACLA with regards to Palestine is an hour-long conversation in and of itself. But with that said, you know, what else would you like to highlight? What else would you like to point out? And what else do you hope people take from this upcoming project from NACLA?
You know, as you said, Oscar, there's, I mean, a lot of great articles that look at Latin America and Palestine, looking at the prism of Latin America and Palestine that can take us in a lot of different places. There's a lot of different ways of analyzing these two places or where these two places converge, whether that be in solidarity, but also in state-level forms of oppression, right? And how, for example, some of these governments, even though they purport to advance progressive policies, still rely on, for example, armament shipments from Israel, which is one of the largest weapons manufacturers in the world. We, of course, some of your listeners may be familiar with Israeli intervention in Central America and the role that they played in the Guatemalan and the Mayan genocide. Today, Chile still relies on Israeli surveillance technology to look over to surveil Mapuche territory. There's a great article by Paolo Zebecci, who's a Uruguayan journalist, who talks about Palestine and Latin America from a top-down and bottom-up perspective. As you mentioned, Nikki Duda has a great piece on the cultural connections between Chileans and Palestinians. I mentioned also Morden Biyan, who is the Mapuche leader, and the Otenio that she put out late last year, part of the archives. There's different articles on solidarity and the student encampments. One of the last piece that came out a little in mid-September, It's a great piece by an organizer and PhD student at Brown, Joyce Matos, who interviewed a rock star of this Chilean-American hip-hop group, Rebel Diaz, who Sadra Yuan, and talk about the role of Palestine within the hip-hop radical tradition. And so why sort of Palestine has been so prominent in their career and in shaping their political consciousness and shaping some of their lyrics. There's a great quote that opens up the piece from Method Man, who actually has this song called PLO Style, and making the connections, making the connections with the resonance between, struggle and, as I mentioned earlier, and resilience, and perseverance, survivance, which were pillars of, the roots of hip hop. We may have gone, we just passed the 50th anniversary of hip hop, and we may have gone beyond that because now it's been so commercialized. But if we, if we look back at the origins of hip hop and, founded in, officially in 1973 at the height of neoliberalism, it was an art form that at its core was about resistance and building community. And you see hip hop resonate with so many different peoples around the globe, including a lot of great Palestinian artists. And so that's the latest piece to come out. And then looking ahead to the issue, the journal issue, which is more substantial and more in-depth, we're going to have some great articles there. We're going to have a piece on, and this is a sneak peek exclusive to your listeners because none of this is out yet, but we'll have some piece on campus, on the campus protest, and we're going to have a roundtable, which I'm really looking forward to, that has brought together organizers, student organizers from around the Americas in conversation with those on U.S. campuses. Yeah, and a piece by Linda Kiki, who's a geographer who's working with a lot of folks on the ground in Central America.
Fantastic. That's amazing. Like I said before, each article out there seems like an hour-long conversation in and of itself. I would love to have each and every one of them on the show as well. I just want to give a quick shout out to one of my friends and colleagues who's also on this list, which is Carlos Berrios Polanco, who did a Puerto Rican point of view on Gaza solidarity as well. And so with that said, we've been speaking with Georgie Garza, who's a translator, popular educator, and postdoctoral researcher at Binghamton University in New York. He is also a member of the Faculty for Justice in Palestine. His August article in NACLA is entitled Weaving Solidarities Across Abya Yala and Palestine. I hope to hear more from this project as well and try to get each and every guest here on the show. But in the meantime, Georgie Garza, it's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you for being on the show with us.
Thank you, Oscar. Thank you to all the listeners. And with Calzachu y Palestina, Free Palestine, and in Quechua, Tupananchiskama. Thank you all.
Fantastic. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao. We'll be right back.
As Tuesday, November 5th approaches, the Pacifica Network is preparing to bring you relevant and resonant election night coverage. The coverage will include discussion of the most salient issues of this election cycle, as well as updates on down-ballot races, state and local initiatives, and on-the-ground reporting from coast to coast. Voter suppression, Palestine, the economy, immigration, abortion rights, and so much more are at stake with this presidential election. November 5th, 8 p.m. until midnight, you'll hear analysis, discussion, and community voices from around the country presented by the Pacifica Network. The day after, November 6th, Verna Avery Brown hosts What's at Stake, the morning after post-election coverage. That's Tuesday, November 5th, 8 p.m., and Wednesday, November 6th, 9 a.m., election coverage, as only WPFW can present it. WPFW, presenting a better world, one broadcast at a time.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump will host dueling rallies within 7 miles of one another tonight in a final push for votes in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Democrats know they must turn out voters in Milwaukee, also home to the state's largest black population, to counter Trump's support in the suburbs and rural areas. Yesterday, both candidates were in the critical swing states of Arizona and Nevada, hoping to win over Latino voters. While in Arizona, Harris criticized remarks Trump made at a rally Wednesday, where he claimed he would protect women, quote, whether the women like it or not, close quote. She framed the comment as a warning about the potential consequences of a second Trump presidency for women. Meanwhile, Trump is facing more backlash for comments he made yesterday in Arizona during a campaign event with former Fox News host Tucker Carlson. Trump described Liz Cheney, one of his most outspoken Republican critics, as a Republican war hawk and suggested she should stand, quote, with 9 barrels shooting at her, close quote. Former Trump aide Alyssa Farah Griffin called on Republican members of Congress to denounce Trump's language, which she called unpresidential and reckless. In more news, dozens of people were killed in Israeli strikes on Gaza yesterday that included an attack on a school housing displaced families in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. And in Lebanon, Israel bombed Beirut for the first time in nearly a week. At least 10 strikes hit the southern suburbs after the Israeli military issued evacuation warnings. The strikes came a day after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met U.S. officials to discuss a possible deal to end the war in Lebanon ahead of Tuesday's U.S. presidential election. Lebanese interim Prime Minister Najim Mikati said the attack on Beirut and military evacuation orders on other Lebanese cities were indicators that Israel rejected efforts to reach a ceasefire. In related news, an analysis of satellite data by the Washington Post reports nearly 5,900 buildings, or nearly a quarter of all buildings, in 25 Lebanese municipalities near the Israeli border had been damaged or destroyed as of Saturday. In addition, a review of videos by the Post shows more than a dozen controlled demolitions carried out by the Israeli military, damaging or destroying at least 9 religious sites. More than 834,000 people have been displaced in Lebanon since October 2023, according to the International Organization for Migration. And the U.S. economy added only 12,000 jobs last month, the slowest pace of hiring since the peak of the pandemic. The numbers were the result of a broad cooling of the labor market, plus major hurricanes and a debilitating labor strike by Boeing machinists. The unemployment rate held steady at 4.1%. The data release also contained revised job numbers for August and September, with over 100,000 fewer jobs added in those months than previously estimated. The October numbers were significantly below what economists forecasted. The data means Federal Reserve policymakers are almost certain to reduce a benchmark interest rate over recession fears. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.